Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, this is Janine, and you're listening to Lunch with Loudon. Coffee Party Internet Radio is a part of the Be the Media Project. In addition to Lunch with Loudon, usually on Thursdays at noon Pacific, we have Politics Done Right with Egberto Willis on Saturday morning. I Take Liberty with My Coffee with Bobby Rodrigo every very early Sunday morning. A new show. A Muslim and a Catholic wake up in America, and I don't remember the time, and soon to return Medium Ground with John Henry on Friday evenings. Watch for special events like book club, movie club, town halls on Monday nights from Coffee Party USA. If you'd like to join our team, go to www.coffeepartyusa.com/volunteer. Be the media. Well, it's another dangerously hot and dry day in the big house in Little Woods. It was 106 here yesterday. It's 105 today. There are fires up and down the West Coast, so please think good thoughts for us, and as always. My regular listeners are probably wondering why I'm broadcasting on Friday. As luck would have it, and I actually mean luck, I woke up Thursday with a migraine, and I couldn't find a substitute host to fill in, but no worries. Don't worry. I was up before dawn, hoping the meds would kick in and watching live TV, and with so much respect and so much excitement, because just 100 miles north of where I sit right now, the Greenpeace 13 were suspended from the St. John's Bridge in Portland, Oregon, above the Willamette River, and there were hundreds of local kayaktivists from Shelno in the river below. It was spectacular. I got to watch the kayaks take the river. I got to see the icebreaker come down river. I got to watch it make a U-turn right in the middle of the river and head back to dock. And oh, what an exciting bit of live TV. It was unbelievable. I almost forgot that I had a headache. And then, of course, as the day went by, you know, after the protesters had been suspended for like 40 hours, but 12 hours after the turnaround in the middle of the Willamette River, the Shell contracted icebreaker came back upriver, and with the assistance of local law enforcement, the nonviolent civil disobedient bridge hangers were nonviolently and respectfully removed to the point that the icebreaker could make it through. 6 hours after that, the icebreaker was headed for the Astoria Bridge, the Astoria Bar, and an hour after that, it was at sea with its 12-day journey back to Dutch Harbor. Man, it made more than great TV. It made history in terms of I'm not sure I've ever seen an act intended to create awareness of a situation, of a circumstance, ever be so successful at obtaining, accomplishing its mission. But that's what this show is about. What was the mission? We'll come back to that. I fondly remember the level of peaceful civil disobedience back in the 70s, as part of the Trojan Decommissioning Alliance, and in partnership with many amazing organizations. If I made a list, then I'd leave somebody out, and so I don't want to make a list, but we created and executed a strategy that, after many years and many well-executed protests, even arrests and a trial, the result was the closure and demolition of the Trojan nuclear power plant in St. Helens, Oregon. these other ones. I digress. I know you all have thoughts on a few things around nonviolent civil disobedience. Like, was this lawful? Was this necessary? Why not drill in the Arctic in the first place? And so if you have questions or answers to any of these questions, please call 646-929-2495 and press 1 to be put in the host queue. And please, please, please call in if you were there. I want to hear your story, and I want to thank you personally. I've posted the announcement for this show everywhere I could. I've called everyone I can. Who knows if we'll actually have an on-the-site report, but I would be just thrilled if we did. So a little history for those of you that wonder what the big deal is. Environmentalists have struggled to prevent and successfully prevented drilling in the Arctic wilderness for years and years and years. Even back when we were protesting our faulty nuclear power plant in Oregon, this was a debate. It was on the table in 1970 and before. In 2008, President Bush allowed offshore Arctic drilling, or created the opportunity for offshore Arctic drilling. And remember, those the rights to do any of these things are leased by the federal government to private corporations. So he made that leasing possible. In 2010, there was a moratorium on all offshore drilling after the tragedy, the BP tragedy in the Gulf of Mexico. And frankly, you know, I read a story last week about more oil washing ashore, so that one's not over. And, that would be the topic of another show. 2012, Shell got the go-ahead and made an attempt at exploratory drilling. And if we want to get into the details of what went wrong, I'm happy to do that. And so if you have questions about the details, but let's just say the whole thing was called a debacle. And after problem and failure after failure, it was just brought to a halt. And in 2013, there was even an op-ed in Forbes that said everyone should just abandon, and especially Shell should abandon this idea of drilling in the Arctic. It is too complicated. It is too dangerous. And the consequences of mishap are too devastating. And frankly, if you do a little search of the literature, what you'll find is that many other companies who had been interested in Arctic drilling, not just in Alaska, but, you know, Arctic drilling anywhere, set that aside, put it on the back burner, because the Shell experience was so devastating in 2012 and was so unsuccessful and was so costly. So in 2015, after many false starts, not the least of which is putting a 3-foot hole in the side of its icebreaker that had to come all the way from Dutch Harbor, a 12-day journey to the docks at Swan Island in Portland, Oregon. you know, a 3-foot hole in the side of the icebreaker. So it's just one of many, many, many breakdowns that have occurred this year. And so Greenpeace has been tenacious through this entire process in trying to make the point that this is too dangerous and that, frankly, if they can be stopped, if Shell can be delayed until September 24th, they have to pull up their tent and come home, because September 24th is the mandated end of drilling, because the ice just becomes too treacherous. And frankly, there's nobody to rescue them if they get stuck there. You know, the Coast Guard has banned only one icebreaker because of austerity. And so, and the ability for anyone to respond to such a remote location should there be a disaster, even just to try to save human life, is no small deal. It's very difficult. It's very expensive. So the protesters were not kidding when they said every second of delay is important. And so even though the ultimate delay to the icebreaker was only, 12 hours, they consider it a victory. So before I take any questions, I want to share with the national audience, since those of you who listen from the West Coast know most of this, but I want to share with the national audience the response by Oregon's elected, their response to the protest. I have a press release from Senator Jeff Merkley, a statement from Governor Kate Brown, and a statement from Portland Mayor Charlie Hales, and I'll try to abbreviate their responses, but they're very telling. On July 17th, Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley announced the Stop Arctic Ocean Drilling Act of 2015, a major piece of legislation to stop offshore Arctic drilling. The legislation wouldn't prevent any new or renewed leases, would prevent any new or renewed leases for the exploration, development, or production of oil, natural gas, or any other mineral in Arctic planning area. It's a very big deal. The quote in the press release is, "A spill in the Arctic would be an environmental catastrophe of extraordinary proportions. And such a spill is inevitable, too fragile, and the ability to respond to a spill in this region is non-existent. Drilling in the Arctic Ocean is the height of irresponsibility. We need to put it off limits permanently," end quote. The press release goes on to say that the Department of Interior estimates that there is a 75% chance of a large oil spill exceeding 42,000 gallons of oil should drilling leases in the Arctic be developed. To date, there has not been a successful oil and gas operation in the Arctic Ocean, ever. The Arctic region is home to one of the world's most delicate ecosystems, extreme and treacherous conditions, and severely limited capacity to respond to a spill or an accident. The press release goes on, but I think you get his drift. He's like saying, this doesn't pencil out. This just doesn't pencil out. I also note was that Senator Merkley attended a rally in Portland, Oregon, sponsored by No Shell Portland kayakivists in preparation for the arrival of the shell icebreaker. So he's pretty serious about this. So Governor Kate Brown made a statement, and I'll pick pieces of that one out. Governor Kate Brown personally opposes drilling for oil in the Arctic, her spokeswoman made clear Thursday afternoon. When asked this morning, which was yesterday, by the U.S. Coast Guard for permission to close the St. John's Bridge so police could pull up 13 dangling Greenpeace protesters in a risky high-wire operation, the governor nonetheless gave the request her blessing. Quote, "Today is not about sympathy for that cause," she said. "It's about cooperation with federal authorities who are trying to enforce the law." So she's saying she groks the cause. She groks what they're trying to do, and we have a law to enforce, and that's her job, and so be careful and do it right. So Charlie Hales, this is his quote, again, the mayor of Portland, where this all took place. "Just like there's a point at which any First Amendment exercise occupying public is eventually going to have to be ended and life has to go on. But again, protests are helpful. They highlight issues people are passionate about, and they lead to changing laws. We are a nation of laws. And if people want drilling in the Arctic to stop, we need to change the law. That's the point these protesters are making with this very dramatic gesture. And we support and appreciate that right to protest. But we also have a city that needs to be operate here, and at some point, that needs to get going again." So again, compliance with state, national, federal, whatever law, respectful compliance, but equal, if not greater, respect for the purpose of this. What's this really necessary? I talked about how there's just been one mishap after another in the Arctic, in the attempts to explore the possibility of drilling in the Arctic Ocean. And one article I read had this great little list, and it just bulleted the issues of the moment. one disastrous attempt by Shell to drill for oil in the Arctic in 2012 resulted in huge fines and felony convictions for one of its contractors. Two failed Coast Guard inspections on Shell's oil rigs, 75% chance of oil spill if Shell successfully extracts oil in the Arctic. And so far, $7 billion spent in drilling and on drilling and exploration and nothing to show for it. So it's increasingly obvious that Shell isn't prepared for Arctic drilling. Frankly, no one is. That's why no one ever has. It's not the conditions under which this is attempted to happen are beyond my personal comprehension. I read some of the technical articles and it's like, wow, you know, the capping device is crushed like a beer can. That was a quote from the Secretary of the Interior. Crushed like a beer can. That just makes me feel like they could cap a leak. And the world will never be prepared. It's too risky. And we have too much evidence that it won't go well and not any evidence that it will go right. So, coming back to the fundamental question, so what is civil disobedience? Technically, I guess like by definition, civil disobedience is refusal to obey a law or follow a policy believed to be unjust. Practitioners of civil disobedience usually base their actions on moral rights and employ the nonviolent technique of passive resistance in order to bring wider attention to the injustice. And I stole that definition of civil disobedience from infoplead.com. So I think that's a pretty good description of not only what was attempted by the Greenpeace 13, but also by what actually happened. Government, law enforcement, they were also in the mode of managing nonviolent civil disobedience in a respectful and firm way. So, that sounds good to me. And then the question of, obviously, if you're exercising civil disobedience, you're refusing to obey a law. One of the things that Shell brought up when interviewed, they made a statement about the Greenpeace 13 protest, and they said, in part, it was not lawful and it was not safe. And so the question that came to me was, so what's lawful? What does lawful mean? Like, no kidding, because I find that people have different... you know, you sort of talk about circumstantial ethics, so to speak. I mean, we have different interpretations of what that means. And I just wanted to add a little bit here to this conversation about lawful, given my history, not only as a business owner with 40 employees in three Western states, but also prior to that, my being involved in middle management in multinational organizations. So, the accusation from Shell that the Greenpeace 13 protest was not lawful is very interesting to me, because it's well known that there is corporate strategy always to weigh the cost of following the law against the cost of not following the law. What are examples? So think of it this way. A fine is imposed by a court when you're convicted of a criminal offense. A penalty is issued by some authority when you have not complied with the law, but you have not committed a criminal offense. See, there's an interesting little gray zone in there. This means that you do not get a criminal record, like think parking violation or fare evasion or what. If you fail to pay the penalty, you have to go to court, and you may have to pay a fine and go criminal record. So it's kind of like you kind of broke the law. Here's your penalty. Don't make me push this any farther. Don't let me take this infraction to the level of crime. So think penalty is civil law, and fine is criminal law. Okay. So in 2014, Shell was fined, remember, fined is criminal law, by the U.S. and the U.K. for overstating its oil reserves. 150 million dollar fine. Criminal law fine, 150 million. Wow. Another example, some of you might remember, was WorldCom, part of the big, big, big value collapse on Wall Street in 2000. But they were fined $750 million for their accounting fraud in 2000. Lots of people lost their retirements on this one, and yet they were still fined. This is 2012, operational contractor was fined $2.2 million for 8 felony offenses associated with the 2012 Shell Arctic exploration debacle. And if you don't think that's actually a phrase, Google it. You know, it's the Shell, the Shell Arctic exploration debacle. And you will actually get recounts. You'll get references to what happened in 2012. Now, on the other hand, yesterday, Greenpeace was fined $2,500 per hour for every hour after, I think, 10 o'clock yesterday morning until they came down, which was 6 o'clock yesterday afternoon. So $2,500 per hour. If they stuck around another day, it went up. Another day, it went up. You know, by Sunday, I think it was going to be like $10,000 an hour. But the point is, they were down before then. But you sort of get the magnitude here. They were fined $2,500 an hour, and that was because they were in contempt of court because an Alaska court had issued a restraining order, is what it amounted to. I'm trying to think of the actual word. I apologize that, I'm still reading all of this with a migraine. So they were basically told they can no longer block or interfere with any of the Shell vessels or acts of, trying to go to a job site to perform at a job site, basically hands off. This whole unlawfulness thing is really kind of interesting to me because lots of unlawful things happen. You get a parking ticket, you pay $25, or you get so the fact that Greenpeace was fined, the fact that Greenpeace resisted compliance with a directive from the court isn't as big a deal as it sounds, or it can be made to sound. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. It can be made to sound. And I think it's important when we sort of put up our narrative manipulation radar, it's important that we know that not all law is equal. Not all enforcement is the same. That, it's not unlike, I don't want to go too far with this, but it's really not unlike, hey, you get stopped for a traffic violation and you get shot by a policeman. You know, there's nowhere in the world where, in that case, the punishment did not fit the crime. Mouthing off to an officer is not the same kind of crime. And so, I want you to consider the possibility that this Greenpeace fine was not only a sign of how minor this was, but it was also a sign of, how do you link this? Maybe I can come up with a better example. There were few or no arrests at the protest. One young man was arrested. He was on a different bridge. His name is Robert, by the way. And thank you, Robert, for your commitment. And what he did was take a bicycle, one of those U-locks, and lock himself, put it around his neck, and lock himself to the railroad bridge, a different bridge in St. John. And he was arrested and removed from the bridge and detained. And he will most likely, if he hasn't shown up in court already, he will. There was a kayak activist who sort of got carried away in the water and, you know, that person was cuffed and taken away. But seriously, in terms of violence or criminal activity, low, low, low. As a matter of fact, one of the most interesting, beautiful things is that there was actually an issue for a long time about who had jurisdiction of the airspace above the river and below the bridge. Thought it, well, the Oregon Department of Transportation had jurisdiction on the bridge itself, and they were hanging from the bridge so they could act on that basis. And then notions of obstruction of interstate commerce and all that can come into play. But there actually had to be, somebody had to figure out exactly not only what was going on, but what law was being broken or what court order was being non-complied with, bad grammar, I know. And then also what, who actually had the authority, the jurisdiction to do anything about it. So I so appreciate it when we struggle with due process of law and when both sides of the conversation honestly struggle with that or present options to one another, you know, present options. And so impressed. But getting back to the whole fine thing, there is, I've alluded to earlier, there's a whole strategy based on the cost of non-compliance is a standard industry practice. And so if you want to take it away from this political notion about energy independence or any of that, take it out of this arena totally. Think of the guy down the way who's got a smokestack and refuses to upgrade to current environmental standards, thinks they're a hoax. Okay, and so then pretty soon some Department of Environmental Quality comes in and they start saying, hey, you're non-compliant, and they start fining them. And so in the process, you know, the fines build up and stuff, you know, but the point is somebody at that operation for the shareholder, a better deal to not comply and pay the fine. And let's see, there's other examples. I'm sure you can all think of them. Think of the places that have been fined for health and safety violations. Think of the places, you know, that, and they actually decide it's cheaper to, or more cost effective. I don't want to use the word cheap. It's more cost effective to pay fines, to pay lawyers, to stretch a process out than it is to just comply. That's another good example that, you know, anybody in chat, you are, you're welcome to sort of add to this, but that's another good example. So health and safety is a good one. Environmental compliance is a good one. My favorite, the quote-unquote Obamacare, now that the president's okayed that term, I'll use it, but the Affordable Care Act, there are companies out there willing to pay the fine rather than give health insurance. And that's because of a CBA, a cost-to-benefit analysis, and applying the strategy called the cost of noncompliance. And so because you could almost accuse, if you want to accuse, you could accuse Greenpeace of having done that same analysis. And the cost of noncompliance, the $2,500 per hour, whatever, was a cost of doing business that they were absolutely willing to absorb. Just like the cost of sending of having a legal team in Alaska to be in the courtroom when Shell was asking for its determination that Greenpeace was in noncompliance. And all of this sort of paints an interesting backdrop. We, you and me, everyday people who do our best to be informed, who formulate opinions, who are willing to enter into discussion, who are willing to struggle with that this sort of inherent tension that comes in a country that is based on the rule of law, but embraces two very conflicting notions. The one of liberty, which is about people themselves, and the one about justice. So liberty and justice for all, a country with a body of law that supports the rights of the individual and supports the rights of society at the same time. How do people like us deal with big issues, right? So, you know, Janine has a little talk show for an hour every week, and I donate to certain organizations, and I participate in certain kind of social media engagement because I like the discussion and I want to know more and I want my insights to be shared. Like, oh, I know what you're talking about. This is what I thought. This is what I found. This is what I think now, okay? But at some point, if you really want to have something happen, so many of us, all us little people, or as, you know, the framers like to call us, we the people, need to come together virtually, in reality, somehow we have to align. And so the single greatest purpose of the strategy that we saw unfold on the St. John's Bridge yesterday was for all of us to think about Arctic drilling at the same time. And to bring as many people up to speed with the issue. Because, you know, I could have told you before yesterday what I thought about Arctic drilling, and maybe I'm better informed than some and less informed than others. But I tell you, today I know so much more than I knew 3 days ago. It's not funny. And why? I know it because there were yellow and, well, gold and red ribbons flying off the same John's Bridge, you know, heroes in the seaweed hanging there, shouting to the world, pay attention to this. This matters. Now is the time to act. That's what happened years ago in Oregon. That's what happened when, you know, the Trojan Decommissioning Alliance and other concerned groups from all over the country, let alone all over the world, came together and made huge public statements to bring up awareness so that you and I, the busy people who do everything we can to be informed about as many things as we can be, know when action is meaningful. One of the things I posted yesterday were seven different petitions you could sign. Okay, there's nothing scary about signing a petition. Chances are nobody's going to come knock on your door or tap your phone because you signed a petition. But there's seven different petitions out there from Credo and Sierra Club and, you know, you name it, including Greenpeace, of course, and Shell No, and a group, an Alaskan group that's there to preserve the Arctic, that, you know, includes amazingly credentialed engineering professors from the university there in Fairbanks. I mean, there are a lot of people out there who have been asking for our support, not the least of which is my own senator, Jeff Merkley. And he's very willing to spend time helping people to understand why this is not a good thing, why it shouldn't happen, and what you can do now. And the quote from the Greenpeace organizer yesterday, the person sort of in charge of it all, and I promise you there was a lot of all, rescue teams and lawyer teams, and the ground support for the Greenpeace 13 was huge. Not to mention the PDX kayakers, who were totally unexpected and a gift to the event. You now is follow through. Millions more people know about this issue. Millions more people know now that it's not like no one has ever drilled in the Arctic Ocean. Never. And there's reasons why. And every attempt to do so from time beginning until today has told us back off. You know, if this is your last resort, really, you've got to look for something else. This is not going to play out well. So the organizer said, and I'm going to get as close to the quote as I can. She said, today is the day for everyone to let the president of the United States know we need to stop this now. So all those petitions, they're all sent straight to President Obama. Jeff Merkley's bill, of course, is in Congress. So ultimately, who will sign that bill? President Obama, if it goes through. Why? How could that bill possibly make it through Congress? We all have elected. You know, we have senators, we have representatives, and we need to tell them what we want. And we need to be strong in terms of being willing to stand there and say, okay, I signed my petition, I called my elected, I've shared information that I have vetted and considered credible, which of course is a huge commitment to responsibility in social media. I support the groups that are doing the things I want to do, and by golly, I just might show up in front of the courthouse, or I just might show up the next time the Kai activists are out, and I might just stand there and be present and accounted for. And a part of the faith of we the people who want the law to change. No one's pretending here that this what Shell is doing is illegal. What they're saying is it will be disastrous and the law must change. It must be made not legal again. Only legal since 2008. Never, never, never successfully executed. Lots of examples about why this isn't a good idea. And it's time to say we're done with this experiment. If America needs homegrown energy, we need to find another way. And of course, that's probably also the topic of a different show, you know, just exactly how many ways could we do that other than what we do. Ah, I see I have a caller. I'm sorry to be so long-winded. I'm so passionate about this. We have a caller from 808. Ah, Hawaiian Islands. I'm trying to open. Aloha and welcome to Lunch with Loudon.
All right, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, I'll take you off speaker. I've been listening, and it's so awesome. Hey, I just wanted to make a shout out. I'm was a member of the Trojan Decommissioning Alliance. I know you know that. I do want to shout out to Four Laws on Board and Lloyd Marbet, because beyond what us demonstrators did, that it was the legal arm that, like you were talking about, that really ended nuclear power in Oregon. I don't know if you remember construction work in progress law that was
absolutely
passed in Oregon. And that's what really stopped it. And with the help of the Gray Panthers, it was a coalition of so many people. Anyway, so...
Well, no, I think that's an excellent point. It's an excellent point that the legal arm, like Trojan Decommissioning Alliance, didn't have the financial power, but Four Laws on Board did.
It was through donations, I imagine. We were kind of like the publicity arm of the movement. You know, we educated people through our trials and just press coverage. We got lucky because they weren't checking for jurisdiction, and they arrested us. PGE arrested us not on their property. So it was kind of hard to convict when we weren't on their property to be arrested. We were on the railroad, and they didn't get permission to arrest. So in some ways, they've gotten smarter now. They checked for jurisdiction, who was responsible for that space where they were arresting people.
Oh, exactly. As a matter of fact, my research into that says they spent a lot of time, and they didn't actually have a decision and a strategy until 3:30 or 4 o'clock yesterday. Now, luckily, they have Portland Fire and Rescue, have the ability to do the repelling and down to cut the secondary safety for the people who are hanging, and then they have the technical climbing knowledge to lower the protesters down. I mean, they're very careful. But, you know, we knew exactly who closed the bridge. The railroad got involved. Of course, the Willamette River, for those of you who don't know, actually divides two states.
Some people were probably in Washington. They only moved two people, right? It looked like.
In Oregon, on the Oregon side.
on the Oregon side. So Oregon had taken care of it and stuff. Well,
yes.
You know, that's part of the thing. When you do these civil disobedience, being arrested and going through trial or whatever it is part of it. You sign up for it. You're ready for that. I have nothing but, you know, they inspired me and reminded me of my youthful days. Kudos to the kayakers, all of them. I'm so proud of them all. And I'm hoping a lot of education did get out there and information, just like when people were trying to block the drilling rig out of Seattle.
Yes.
You know, we can only, you know, people can educate as far as changing laws. That's going to be tougher against these mega corporations. But other than, you know, my question or my thought mm-hmm. that I'm wondering if there's anyone out there that knows about, you know, the cost, you know, what is the make money, the breaking point of price per barrel of oil that they're going to pump? Right now, the price of oil is going down per barrel. And I thought, mm-hmm. you know, like the frackers actually need over like $100 a barrel, and they're not there now. What does the Arctic drillers need to make per barrel to make money? And are they counting?
You know, that's,
are they counting on it going up?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because I'm going to revert first to my business self, and if anybody out there wants to look Google that, I'll do it in a second. But here's the thing. There's more than one kind of cost analysis, right? And so there's the literal and immediate, I need $100 a barrel to frack, and so I'm just going to, when it drops to 97, I stop fracking, right?
Right?
And I sit and wait. And with some commodities, you can literally do that. You can sit and wait. Or with some agricultural products, you can say, not planting next year. Or, you know, you increase the herd size or decrease the herd size. I mean, there's a lot of ways that you respond to the ability of the market to purchase. And then there's other things that make less fiscal sense. And it's part of it is like, hey, I spent $2 billion on this mineral rights lease, which is what Shell paid, $2 million. Which is,
so whether they drill or not, they're putting out that money?
Uh-huh. And remember, they're not even trying to drill right now. They're trying to do exploratory drilling, which actually means is that this is like a research project. And so they're actually trying to design drilling apparatus, emergency response apparatus, protocols for risk management that will work in Arctic conditions, because those things already do not exist. Now, the future value of a capping mechanism that works and protocols that tell you when to run. I mean, one of the things that happened in 2012 is they waited too long to run from an iceberg or a storm or something. Anyway, so they were towing their platform in. It didn't make it. It got washed ashore. I mean, so the protocol for Arctic drilling doesn't exist, and let alone the technology. The future value, if they were able to actually create a drilling technology, Arctic drilling protocol, and methodology that actually worked, it would be almost priceless. And so I think what they're going for, I mean, if I were their fiscal manager, I would be, and I were doing what they do, the only thing that makes sense is they believe that the return on having technology and protocols that actually work would reap a lot of money, a lot of money. Because remember, in 2012, their contractor was fined $150 million. How many barrels of oil do you have to, you know, drill to make $150 million? And so my question is similar to yours, and I'm so glad you brought it up, because I've got it right here in the piece of paper in front of me. I didn't look. My question was kind of the inside out of what you just asked. What is the budget for failure? In other
words,
how many fines did they plan on? How many penalties Did they plan on? How many legal hours did they plan on from the beginning? And I promise you, if you're Royal Dutch Shell, all of that is in the budget for this effort.
Right. Do the shareholders know? I mean, I know there's a divest movement, and
yes,
maybe that is, you know, one of the forks in this that can be, you know, people need to be educated that you're probably going to lose money on these investments.
Yes.
And I just hope they don't get bailed out by the United States or whoever. And
well, that, yeah, and I do think that this is a great tool, and again, thanks for connecting the dots here, because there is a huge divest from fossil fuel investments.
Right.
It's a big one in the state of Oregon. I don't know what it is in the state of Hawaii, but nationwide, you know, my husband's a Princeton graduate. Princeton is looking at divesting. I mean, universities and foundations and governments all over the United States are battling, discussing this very issue. And so I think the timing of the protest is amazing because it really did was a call to action on the level of you, Janine, go find out more, and you won't like what you find. They didn't go nanny, nanny, poo-poo. The most nanny, nanny, poo-poo I heard in the whole thing yesterday was one of the spokespeople said, we need ice, not oil. We need
yes.
an intact polar ice cap way more than we need oil. And if you don't understand the logic behind that, go do your homework.
Yes, we do. That is a brilliant point. We need ice, not oil. It's bad enough. You know, I live Hawaii, so I'm out in the middle of that ocean that is warming, and the level of humidity happening here is like nothing I've ever experienced in all my years of living here. How high, day in, day out, even now that we have trades today, the humidity is not dropping. You know, although I'm going to end my complaint right there because I know Oregon is burning. Alaska is burning.
Right.
The humidity level is very low there, and things are on fire. So I'll take this terrible humidity, although I do have a hurricane coming my way, but I'm not worried about that. And one last, I don't know if you have any other callers, but I got a crackpot theory, a tinfoil hat theory, is why about going, the people who want to go to war in Iran, is that one issue, that one disastrous move, war in Iran, will push oil back up. Peace with Iran will push oil prices way down as their oil comes legally onto the world market.
Ah.
So is Arctic drilling tied in with the pro-war people? I don't know. It's just a crazy thought that would be horrific if it was true.
Well,
so
let me
that's the last of my, I'll take off my tinfoil hat now.
Well, not quite yet. I can see that one. In my research in the last 24 hours, one of the things I found out is maybe not, there's one of the shell companies, a big one, and I apologize for not remembering right now, but I promise you the article about it is posted on the Lunch with Loudon Facebook page. So any article I've alluded to in the broadcast today and a few other background pieces that we maybe haven't gotten to yet, they're all posted on the Lunch with Loudon Facebook page. I try to put them there so either before the broadcast or after, people can go. They don't have to do all the searching themselves. They can go check out these stories. But one of them is this subsidiary of Royal Dutch Shell. It's 50% owned by Saudis. And so it's not like Arctic drilling is only is an American issue. We actually have no guarantee that anything they get there would even go to America.
Oh, no, it's the world market.
Well, exactly. And, you know, the other part of that, I think it was the same article, was basically saying the rest of the world is waiting. Norway has suspended action. Other countries have suspended the notion of Arctic drilling until they see what the heck Shell can come up with, because they just don't, they're not willing to do that. Here's my budget for fine. Here's my budget for penalties. Here's my budget for environmental calamity. You know, I mean, seriously, you know, BP drew a line in the sand and said this is the limit of our liability a while ago. And last week, there was fresh oil coming up onto the Gulf Coast from that spill. So you tell me when it's over. And the other thing that you may recall is that in the early 80s, Exxon Valdez, huge oil tanker spill. Huge.
Right. They've never recovered.
That still is not recovered. And the Alaskans, I know, will tell you this is true. But the other point is they delayed execution of the legal finding against them for 30 years. I don't know if it's most or at least half of the people who were supposed to receive settlements from Exxon Valdez were dead before they got their determination. Now, I'm sure the money went to their estates, right? But you got to get that on the scale of things. I mean, Shell makes a quarterly profit, not expense, not income, a quarterly profit of over $2 billion. I mean, there gets to be so much money in this equation. It's just like it's actually mind-boggling, right? And
right.
So when you ask yourself, what's in it for them? You know, what's really going on here? And so, hey, the idea that we need the cost of oil to be up so that we can afford to frack and so that we can afford to drill in the Arctic, that actually makes fiscal sense.
War makes sense.
It wasn't, right. Well, fiscal sense.
For them.
And it's, right. And if you believe in the strategy, privatize the profits, socialize the cost.
Right.
So war is a socialized cost. Environmental cleanup is a socialized cost. You know, all these socialized costs, going back to the Trojan nuclear power plant, I mean, the expense of that thing was socialized. The profits
right.
were going to some energy company in the even worse, you have a lot, and interrupt me at any moment to talk about that. But the whole idea that, I mean, there's never been a single dollar of profit from any nuclear power plant that wasn't subsidized by the federal government. So the only profit is actually your tax money. And I figured they'd save money if the federal government just wrote checks to all the investors, because you take out all the middle guys. The truth is, if the government didn't insure them, if the government didn't get their loans, if the government, you know, if we didn't do all that, there couldn't be a nuclear power plant, because they've never operated at a profit on their own ever, ever in the history of nuclear power in this country. Not a dime.
Right. And that's the whole thing with the construction work in progress. It was very simple. You couldn't charge the ratepayers for a plant that wasn't online. Now they got, I think Trojan got grandfathered in, and so people are still paying for the Trojan nuclear power plant that is demolished, but I believe the holding tanks are still there because there's no permanent waste. Never has been any permanent waste disposal for nuclear power plants. Anyway, but that is a side story.
It is a side story, but I think it's an important one, because in the end, you know, you call the Trojan Decommissioning Alliance the publicity. And so some people yesterday called this Greenpeace 13 action a publicity stunt. Exactly.
It's an educational stunt. That's not a stunt, but an action. It's an educational action. That's what I would call
exactly.
it. Because that's what we brought attention and through our attention, there was education. I mean, in our first trial, we were found not guilty because they arrested us on the railroad, and out of the jury came an affinity group to fight nuclear power plant out of St. Helens, where we had been primarily, you know, the valley in the St. Helens area. There was no, you know, affinity group. But after the trial, these jurors who listened to expert testimony were shocked that this was in their community and that they were being endangered by this plant that they had been told was fine, but was not.
They had to listen. Yeah, they had to listen to expert testimony.
Yes.
They had to listen to, you know, they had to actually objectively listen to both sides argue. And they, as you said, they came to their own conclusion, which was, holy moly, right?
And right, because it was a, they used a technicality, but they realized, see, we went in there on the lesser of evil, you know, like nuclear power was a greater evil to us committing this demonstration. But they released us on a technicality because PGE did not even arrest us correctly. Here these people were running a nuclear power plant, but couldn't figure it out that arresting us on the railroad tracks, arresting us on the highway was not their jurisdiction.
Right.
That was, they couldn't do it. They had to wait till we were on their property, but they didn't do that. They arrested us on
right.
not their property. And then they tried an injunction against us, but they failed that too for legal reasons. But this, corporations aren't always the smartest people, but it sounds like they've gotten a little bit smarter over the last, is it 40 years? Almost this short.
Right, right. Well, and actually, it wasn't the corporations that exercised this discussion about jurisdictions and what laws were actually applied and whose job it was to apply them. That was actually
right.
the government and law enforcement of the state of Oregon, state of Washington. There's a railroad, a federal railroad organization. I mean, when they started listing the players, oh, in the counties, Clark County
right.
on the Washington side, Multnomah County on the Oregon side, plus Clackamas County sort of got in there somehow, and then the city, and in this case, the city police bureaus, led by the Portland Police Bureau, which is led by the mayor of the city of Portland. So,
right. so.
They did their homework. The governor did her homework. The governors of both states did their homework. They knew exactly which protesters to take down based on what side of the river they were on. And so, because as you know, for those who don't know, the state line runs down the middle of the river, right? And so,
right.
And I'm sure they actually chose that based on where the channel was, but hey, they might have been asking the governor of Washington if the channel had been on the other side.
Well,
so.
I don't know if there is a city incorporated right there, because you had Portland, so you had the Portland, which is a big, you know, but I don't think Vancouver, or I'm not sure exactly, it's been so long since I've lived in Oregon that exactly.
No, Vancouver's on the other side of the Columbia, so yeah. It's
right, but I don't know, right there, so
Long
Vancouver's
exactly.
not like a big city, I guess it's spewing, I'm not, spreading, I guess that's the word now, but it's
yeah,
not like.
Yeah, well, and it's actually, St. John is now inside the Portland city limits, so it was the city of Portland that handled,
right.
I think, both sides, well, the Oregon
right.
side of the bridge, not the
right.
Washington side of the bridge, and so.
But
and
people
it's
all
probably
over are talking about this.
And people all over have access to very good information. And so I guess that's one of the things, you know, when I saw the interview this morning with the organizer, you know, sitting there in the studio, Channel 6 in Portland, she was like very clear that they considered this an enormous success based on people going to good information sources. And the only people there were counter protesters down by the river. And their basic thing was, we need energy made in America. And I actually don't disagree with that. I don't disagree with that. But again, when you do the cost benefit analysis, it was interesting that you used the term lesser of evil, right? Because the lesser of evil to you and me is a moral conversation. And hopefully it's a moral conversation based on data, right? In other words, there's a moral position that the information swings you one way or the other about. But that's the same conversation that, remember, corporations are not people. And so they have that kind of conversation within the confines of corporation as, which will cost more? Or which, in the short term and in the long term, where's the money? Follow the money. So I have to believe that Shell is banking that their ability to be the leaders in the technology and the methodology of Arctic drilling, they believe will be worth all this money. And yet, what they don't consider, I mean, they might, I'm sure that budget includes a line item for environmental catastrophe. I really believe it does. I cannot believe it, you know, especially after BP, right? It's going to include that line item. But that's where the socialization of the cost comes in. I mean, there's Coast Guard 1,000 miles away that have to come to the rescue, and there's one Coast Guard icebreaker that would come to the rescue, and there are people all over the world who, you know, just like Doctors Without Borders would come running, they're the people that come running when there are oil spills. But what you don't have there are all the people, remember in the Gulf in the BP spill, Deep Horizon, there were people all over the beaches raking up oil, rescuing wildlife. I mean, there were thousands and thousands of people responding to this environmental disaster, right? That's not going to happen in Dutch Harbor. That's not going to happen in Arctic drilling, you know? And so that's why the people who, you know, you can interpret the cost benefit analysis one way, someone else can take the very same numbers and interpret it another way, especially if what they're concerned about is the long-term gain, the long-term value of this technology and methodology. And that's the only thing that makes it make sense. However, there is no morality here that I can see for the consequences to the ecosystem or that you can call it the environment, you can call it the biome, you can call it lots of things. But the point is, damage can be done. And when the Department of the Interior report, believe me, they want this to work because they just made $2 million on the lease and they want to make more leases. I'm sorry, but they're the ones who are saying 75% chance of catastrophic environmental incidents. Would you get in your car and drive downtown if you had a 75% chance of dying on the way? I mean, this is
no, I wouldn't. It's kind of like when there's a flash flood advisory. I tend to stay home if I can, or be very smart. But for the most part, 75% of the time, I'm not going to go out in it.
Right. And,
I'm not going across deep running water or unknown how deep running water is. So, yes, they are going up there, and they won't have the free volunteers like they had in the Gulf. And I don't know, Santa Barbara has another leak, and I don't know where that is. I haven't seen that today. I saw it on the news yesterday. But I will tell you, I went to Twitter, whoever you say, just to do, you know, like retweet. I was looking for the people who were up there because they were tweeting as they were up there. And so I went Greenpeace, and lo and behold, there's people are retweeting about how much did it cost to arrest those people. They're trying to make it like, oh, look, those bad people cost the taxpayers X amount. And my reply was, well, how much is climate change costing us now? I mean, the drought, the floods. It's all that they said was going to start happening. Like I said, the humidity used to, we'd get these spikes whenever a tropical system would go by. But even on days that there's nothing near us, the air is warmer, moister. And I'm kind of, you know, here in Hawaii, we pay a lot for our electricity and wouldn't even consider an air conditioner. But so I sit in front of a fan, and when there, you know, we've had 87% humidity, and you sit in front of a fan and you're still sweating. So climate change is affecting us now. It is costing you, everybody, now. It doesn't, you know, it's our electric bill. It's our, you know, our discomfort, you know. Too bad we can't sue them for pain and suffering for this climate change that they have put on us. But anyway.
Well, but that's just like, you know, the pain and suffering. The people who were counter-protesting yesterday at the river were basically saying, we believe in American-made oil. I don't want any more wars. And so I don't want to go send my kids to the Middle East so that we can continue to have oil flow from there. You know, I mean, there were, these people had responsible points of view. I saw their points of view. What I didn't, you know, in the cost of energy, the cost of gasoline, you know, they had some legitimate concerns. And they are concerns that need to be folded into that whole recipe that says, what are all the costs? What are the short-term costs? What are the long-term costs? And frankly, what is our objective here? And those corporations that are not people have only financial objectives. A few of them have other objectives, and they say so. You know what I mean? Now, do they behave according to those objectives? That's a different story. But the point here is that you and I need to make a decision about the quality of life for ourselves and our children's children, wildlife, blah, blah, blah. You know, I mean, I didn't preach to the choir. So for us, the conversation is quite different than it is for a wealth builder. And for a wealth builder, these other things are actuarial items as opposed to deal breakers. That should be deal breakers. The 75% risk of catastrophe should be a deal breaker. And maybe that's what I'll go, thank you, because that's what I'll send to the president tonight. I'll email the president. I'll say, this is a deal breaker.
Right. Maybe they, like the big banks, need to have a giant proof they have the money to pay for everything before they start drilling. You have in an account that you can't touch. I mean, nothing makes a corporation angrier than not being able to spend money, right, or use it as a asset in their little game of monopoly, right? If it's locked into an account, kind of like the big banks have to prove, you know, have a cushion so if their loans go bad, that we don't have to bail them out, right?
Yes.
So maybe, I know, I guess they just carry insurance, but yes, when is it they're going to show that they're responsible fully for any financial things? Not 10 years from now, up front. Up front, you're going to pay. Because that's what they're not doing. They're not paying, they don't have that money up front.
Right.
Anyway.
Right. And I don't even know how I'd estimate that amount of money given, okay, so what is the estimated cost of the cleanup or mitigation of an Arctic oil leak catastrophe? I mean, how many trillions of dollars?
Right, they probably are just required to carry insurance. But that doesn't get out to people right away. I know the Gulf is still suffering. Santa Barbara, who knows what it's going to cost them? Summertime, hot weather, you can't go in the water?
Well, that plus, remember, if you're talking about socializing the expense, you know, what is the expense of an environmental travesty that will never be repaired? I mean,
right.
You and I have to, at some point, draw that moral line in the sand.
Right.
The corporate, not a person, doesn't.
Right.
It has no...
You know, I have and my other tinfoil thought is that they're thinking they're just going to get the oil before Russia gets it because Russia's rushing up there. I'm sure it's all one big thing, right? And as climate change is happening, everyone's just thinking, oh, we can use that as a trade route, or I can drill there because there won't be so much ice. And I don't know. I think it's all disastrous. Whether Shell has an accident or Russia has an accident, it is all going to be bad. And polar bears will be in zoos with air conditioning. I don't know how they're going to survive.
No kidding. So, mahalo for calling in today. This has been a great conversation. We're coming to the end of our time, but I want to thank you very much. And I want to spend the last couple of minutes, I can leave your mic wide if you like, but I'd like to end by expressing my gratitude and my appreciation for the Greenpeace 13, all the Greenpeace people that supported them to make this a safe and peaceful demonstration, to the people who planned and strategized and recruited and trained and executed this highly successful public awareness campaign that will have us all be talking about Arctic drilling for a long, long time. I want to thank all the kayaktivists. As far as I know right now, we're limited to the Pacific Northwest, especially today. I want to thank the PDX, the Portland kayaktivists, for their enduring commitment to letting us all know not only what the risks are, you know, draw awareness, but also to point, here they come, there they go, here it is, there it went. So we have sort of like this real-time scenario about, you know, where's the platform today? I actually saw the platform in Port Orford Ferry there, going up to Canada, going up to Victoria. Thank you to everyone who successfully executed a peaceful, nonviolent civil disobedience. And so I guess I want to close, too, by saying thank you, Joyce, for everything that the Trojan Decommissioning Alliance did and your part in what led to the decommissioning of that nuclear power plant. So,
or the stopping of Pebble Springs. That was the most important thing, you know.
Yes.
Stopping, because yes. PGE was putting money into Pebble Springs. There would be another nuclear power plant. Like Washington has multiples, California has multiples, Oregon has
zero.
None except for the holding tanks.
Well, and we actually have a training reactor here in Corvallis. We have a
yes, well, that's different. So does Reed. It's not a nuclear power plant. It's a training reactor for their university.
Yeah, they call them engineers, the unclear engineers. Anyway. Well, thank you so much for calling. I've enjoyed our time together. We're at the end of our hour. So I just want to remind everybody that Coffee Party USA has not benefited from Citizens United. We are totally a member-driven organization. If you would like to donate or become a member, go to www.coffeepartyusa.com, find the great big button, and become, you know, participate in whatever level makes you comfortable. And you can start as low as $5 a month. Voting members are $30 a year. And frankly, we've never had, you know, a $10,000 donor, but it could be you, right? And so that would be most excellent. So thank you, everyone. Aloha to our caller in Hawaii, and coffee party on.